Have you ever heard something like, you should be ashamed just for being your true, authentic self? Then Teología Sin Vergüenza might be the place for you. We are queer, trans, feministas from Latin America and its diaspora who aren't ashamed of our faith or our activism. Our weekly conversations offer a space for reflection, analysis, and spiritual reclamation as we try to navigate home, faith, familia, and identity. So grab a cup of coffee, whether it's café con leche, café cubano, café de olla, tinto, chorreado, or americano. Join us for the deep dive into the lives of theologians, elders, activists, and everyday saints as we talk about decolonial faith, gender justice, sexuality, and sacred resistance. I'm your host, Reverend Sex. And for all of those who feel like you aren't enough of this or too much of that, ni de aquí, ni de allá, you belong here. Join us for shameless faith conversations about real life right now that you won't find anywhere else. You might just realize that you are a sinvergüenza too.
Axis Mundi.
Welcome to One Nation Indivisible. I'm Andrew L. Seidel, a constitutional attorney and the author of The Founding Myth and American Crusade. This is a podcast about religion, the law, and the battle for America's soul. We'll be separating church and state, defending freedom and equality, and fighting Christian nationalism. If you haven't already, sign up for our weekly bonus content and ad-free listening at accessmundi.us. LFG, folks. Welcome to One Nation Indivisible. We are on episode 40. I can't believe it. 40 episodes. Time is a crazy circle. And we've got to circle back now to episode 21. This is back in early July to cover another win at the U.S. Supreme Court because the Supreme Court decided not to touch a case. This is the Cambridge Christian School case. You'll remember this is the case, faith, football, and Christian nationalism that we did the episode about, and where we broke the news on this podcast that nobody else had covered, that Brett Kavanaugh was being asked to decide to overturn a case that he lost back in the day when he was a lawyer. All right, so he's a young lawyer. The case gets to the Supreme Court. Brett Kavanaugh writes an amicus brief to the court, and it's this really virulent language, right? A really inflammatory language in the brief that he writes that just throws anybody who's for separation of church and state, anybody who's not religious, under his bus, right? And just runs them over and talks about how Christians will be made bottom of the barrel, worse than the worst of the worst, and lost that case. And First Liberty Institute, one of the Christian nationalist organizations that did, for instance, the Kennedy versus Bremerton case about that coach that was imposing his prayer on other people's kids, brought a new case to the Supreme Court and was asking the court to overturn that old decision, Santa Fe v. Doe, Santa Fe Independent School District v. Doe. Really important case, and truthfully, the last solid win for the separation of church and state that you can say this Supreme Court had. And we were worried that the Supreme Court was going to accept the new case, Cambridge Christian School, that First Liberty had brought. And that case was about whether or not this private Christian school that's playing in public school football playoffs gets to broadcast a prayer over the loudspeakers and impose their religion on everybody using state resources. The answer every court has given has been no, and they're claiming, oh, it violates our religious freedom. It absolutely does not. Nobody's stopping you from praying. They're just stopping you from imposing the prayer on everybody else. And every court has said, no, you don't get to do that. But they wanted, First Liberty Institute wanted the Supreme Court to come in and overturn that Santa Fe decision from 25 years ago. And the Supreme Court declined to take up that case. Now, again, this doesn't mean that they made a decision in the case, right? So in the Cambridge Christian School case, they didn't say, nope, the state was right. They just said, we're not accepting this case for review. This is called certiorari. Remember, at the Supreme Court, you have to petition the court to take your case. And then if the court says yes, you have to argue that you're right. Here, the court denied the petition of certiorari, denied cert. So it's not taking the case, which means the lower court decisions against the Christian nationalists stand. So we are saving that wall of separation between church and state that still exists somewhat. It has been saved. This was the first time I wrote an op-ed for Rolling Stone. It was about that breaking news that Kavanaugh was being asked to decide this case. We don't know if he sat in on that conference or not. We won't know for decades, probably, unless something slips out. The court is a little leakier than normal. But for now, it would normally only take four justices to grant cert in a case, and that didn't happen. Could it be because we created enough of a stink and enough of a hint of scandal? Maybe. I don't know. Probably not. But we can at least be thankful that we were fighting the good fight and made some progress. Huzzah. However, my second op-ed came out in Rolling Stone yesterday, assuming all goes according to plan. I'm recording this Sunday night on November 23rd. On Monday, the 24th, Rolling Stone is supposed to publish an op-ed of mine about the Johnson Amendment, which is this hugely important rule. I'm hoping that you'll all share it. Because the day this episode airs, Tuesday the 25th, there is a huge court hearing going on that you've never heard about. And this is an enormous deal. And it is really to almost save American democracy. And here's why. There exists a crucial rule that keeps tax-exempt donations going to charity. Charitable donations should go to charitable works. That's what the Johnson Amendment says. And for all that you're going to hear about this case, it is a very simple rule. Charitable giving should fund charitable work, not political campaigns. And that is the crux of the case that is happening right now. Because there's a small vocal faction of Christian nationalists trying to gut this common sense rule. And they've been trying to gut it for years. And they failed at every turn. So a couple decades ago, they brought a case and they failed. Well, actually, let me back up. The Johnson Amendment is a very simple rule. It says that nonprofits, including churches, are eligible for a valuable government privilege, tax exemption. And that tax exemption is a privilege. It's not a right. I mean, nobody has a right to be exempt from taxes, not even churches. Tax exemption is a privilege, and the government can attach strings to that privilege. And one string is the Johnson Amendment. And the Johnson Amendment says that all charities, 501c3s, churches, other houses of worships, do not get to endorse or oppose political candidates. In other words, you don't get to take in money that is designated for charity, and you get a tax exemption because you're taking that money for charity, and then turn around and spend that money on political campaigns, partisan political campaigns. Right? That makes perfect sense. It's an important rule. Charitable donations should go to charitable works, not to political campaigns. That's it. That's the rule. Don't take a stance on partisan political campaigns. And Christian nationalists hate this rule. And they've challenged it for decades. They have argued that it burdens their religious freedom and their free speech. Now, their case that they are making is not about free speech or religious freedom. It's about money and power. And they brought a case to the courts decades ago, around the same time as the Santa Fe v. Doe case, actually. And the second highest court in the land, the D.C. Circuit, said, nope, this doesn't violate your religious freedom, doesn't violate your free speech. The rule's perfectly fine. It's there. So they figured out other ways that they could challenge it over the years, continued to try to shift public sentiment with something that the Alliance Defending Freedom ran called Pulpit Freedom Sunday. They failed at that. The rule is hugely popular. People love, love, love the Johnson Amendment. One of the times in Trump 1.0, which I'll get to in a minute, where he promised to utterly destroy this rule, 4,000 faith leaders from all kinds of different backgrounds asked Congress to protect it. 6,000 nonprofits asked Congress to protect it. Lifeway Research, which is an evangelical polling group, their slogan is Biblical Solutions for Life, found that 80% of Americans oppose pastors endorsing a candidate in church, and 75% oppose churches endorsing candidates. Nobody wants this rule to change, except for this small vocal faction of Christian nationalists who are pushing for it to change. They failed at court the first time. They failed to change public sentiment. So they asked Trump in the first Trump administration to sign an executive order gutting the Johnson Amendment. This is back when I was at the Freedom From Religion Foundation. We got word that the order was coming, and I actually crafted a lawsuit that we were able to file the very same day that Trump signed his executive order. And Trump's attorneys actually came into court and admitted that that the order Trump signed did nothing to change the rules. They admitted that in court twice. So we were able to dismiss the lawsuit and say, look, the Johnson Amendment's still there. Trump did nothing to get rid of it. So here's what's happening now. This is the change. This is the trick end run around that they are working to do now, because they failed to successfully do it in front of fair courts. They failed to shift public opinion. They couldn't get Trump to do an executive order that would do this. So now, even though Congress could have changed this rule at any time, what they have done is Michael Farris, who is one of the Christian nationalist lawyers who was he was at the head of a lot of the homeschool cases. He ran the Alliance Defending Freedom, ADF, for a while. He has been kind of really involved on the very far side, the very fringe of the Christian nationalist legal movement for a long time. Brought a case on behalf of a couple groups, including two churches, and they sued in Texas, to try to stop the Johnson Amendment again, to try to get a court to overturn it, because the courts have shifted a lot since that first case was decided 25 or so years ago. But because they really can't win, and because this is settled and it's really not a violation of their religious freedom or their First Amendment, and because they have Donald Trump in office, they're just trying to settle the case to say that the Johnson Amendment is not good law and the IRS can't enforce it. Basically, to declare that the Johnson Amendment violates their free speech and religious freedom and enjoin the IRS from enforcing it against these two churches. That's what they're going to argue. And they proposed a settlement with the IRS that the court could rubber stamp on Tuesday. That could happen. All right. So it's not arguing that the court must do this as a matter of law. It's colluding with Trump's IRS to get the court to rubber stamp a decision that says, yes, this violates our religious freedom. Yes, this violates our free speech, without anybody arguing to the contrary. It's collusion. It's a collusive attempt to settle the case. And it would only apply to these two churches. However, you can immediately know that they're going to bring every church on the Christian nationalist fringe is going to bring its own lawsuit. They're going to get the same settlement, and they're going to wade into partisan politics immediately. And so two things are really important here. First, Americans United for Separation of Church and State got wind of this a long time ago, has been watching the case and knew this settlement was coming and has been involved and is actually going to be in court arguing the case. We have three of our lawyers down in Texas this week arguing the case for Americans United against this settlement, pointing out a whole host of problems with, one, trying to settle a case in a way that would void a federal law that Congress still has on the books, right? But there is such a thing as the separation of powers. It does still exist. So there's just a problem with the way they're doing this. And the second thing is that this would actually blow a huge hole in American democracy. And that's because churches, unlike other 501c, unlike, for instance, Americans United or the Freedom From Religion Foundation, churches do not file any financial disclosures with the IRS, Right, so every nonprofit out there, you can go look up their Form 990. ProPublica has a lot of these. Most nonprofits operate in a transparent manner, and you should be able to find their Form 990s on their website. You should be able to ask for them. They should be out there. This should be a thing. And it tracks every penny that comes in, every penny that goes out of the organization. Because this tax exemption is a public trust. And transparency is a part of maintaining that public trust. But churches don't file any financial disclosures. No financial disclosures at all with the IRS. And that presents a very big problem. Because they're financial black holes. So here's what the situation could look like if the court rubber stamps this settlement. A mega donor, Elon Musk, let's say, decides that he wants to influence an election. And he goes to one of these churches and he says, I'm going to write you a check for $40 million, for $100 million, for $200 million, and I want you to do this with it. He then gets to take a tax write-off because that is a tax-deductible donation. Meanwhile, the church can then turn around and spend that money on political campaigns without any accountability at all. So churches would become super PACs, unregulated, unaccountable, opaque super PACs. And I think you would even see super PACs reorganizing or co-opting churches because they're going to have to do that to compete for donors, because there's no mega donor out there who's going to give their money away when they could give it away and get a tax deduction. It's just not common sense. And in a normal world, we would say, look, this is going to lead to the regulation of churches. You got to rethink this, right? But under a Trump administration, you really think that's going to happen? Of course it's not going to happen. Trump's going to get in on the grift. So gutting this popular rule, this common sense rule, is going to be far worse for our democracy and our society than the Citizens United decision that you've all been worried about for so many years. Rightfully so. It's going to gift a fringe faction with a scary amount of political power, and that is the goal. That is the plan. That is why they are doing this. That is why the lawyer behind this is Michael Farris. Now, again, American United for Separation of Church and State. Lawyers are in court arguing against this. Also trying to intervene in the case, meaning saying, hey, basically, look, the Trump administration's not doing it. The IRS is not doing anything here, right? But they're not even trying to enforce this rule. They're not trying to argue for it. We have an interest in this rule as a nonprofit and as an organization that's defended it for a number of years. So you should let us intervene in addition to letting us have some time for argument here. So we'll see what happens. It's unclear what's going to happen, but I will add too that last week, Representative Jared Huffman, Representative Jamie Raskin, Senator Hirono, Senator Wyden, 13 members of Congress sent a letter to Trump's IRS objecting to the fact that they were trying to do this end run, as they called it, rightfully in my mind, around Congress. And pointed out that separation of powers is still a thing. So again, all this is in my op-ed for Rolling Stone. Please share that op-ed. Please go from Rolling Stone, Andrew Seidel. It'll go find me on my socials. It's out there. Please share it. People need to know about this. I will try to make a couple more videos, maybe share those. This is important. This is dangerous stuff is happening, folks. And this again, would make Citizens United look like chump change, like nothing. This is a huge, huge deal. And just for those of you who may be thinking, yeah, you know, I kind of see that there's like a free speech or a religious freedom angle here. Let me just point out a couple things other than the fact that in Branch Ministries versus Rosati, they said, no, there's no ban or even a burden on free speech or religious exercise. Churches that want to do partisan politicking can do it. They're totally able to do it. Nothing is stopping them. It's just that they want to do it and get their tax exemption, right? They want to have their cake and eat it too. And the classic way that Christian nationalists are always going for legal privilege under the law, that's what they're going for. That's what they want. And also, they could do this personally. So for instance, pastors and preachers could talk about politics, just not in their capacity as a preacher, not from the pulpit. So they can endorse whatever candidate they want on their personal Facebook page or around the dinner table at night or on their show that is not produced by the church. as I can on this podcast, on a show that's not produced by any nonprofits that I'm affiliated with or work for. They can do that. They can't do it using church letterhead or the church pulpit or the church Facebook page or the church podcast, right? Or the nonprofit letterhead or the nonprofit social media or the nonprofit podcast, right? This law was passed in 1954. It did not stop and was never intended to stop Martin Luther King from preaching civil rights from the pulpit. And that's because even this ban does not prevent them from talking about issues. You can still talk about any of the issues that you want, from abortion to gay marriage to marriage equality to whatever you want to talk. You can talk about those issues, but you can't endorse or oppose political candidates. And the rule didn't stop Martin Luther King from preaching civil rights, nor did it stop any of the conservative white churches in the South from opposing King and the civil rights movement. It's just a way to prevent tax-exempt groups from abusing their tax-exempt privilege by engaging in partisan politicking. And the rule is crucial to American democracy. Folks, I can't believe how much we have to cover in this episode. I can't believe we're already this deep. We've still got quite a bit to cover. Trump called for the death of members of the opposition party, called for their execution, because they had the boldness to tell members of the military to not do anything illegal. And this really is one of the more remarkable moments from this latest Trump term. And it has not, in my opinion, been given enough coverage. A few Democrats, veterans, members of the military, or past members of the military, called on current members of the military to refuse illegal orders, to remember and honor their oath of office.
We want to speak directly to members of the military
and the intelligence community
who take risks each day
to keep Americans safe.
We know you are under enormous stress and pressure right now.
Americans trust their military.
But that trust is at risk.
This administration is pitting our uniformed military
and intelligence community professionals
against American citizens.
Like us, you all swore an oath
to protect and defend this Constitution.
Right now, the threats to our Constitution aren't just coming from abroad,
but from right here at home.
Our laws are clear. You can refuse illegal orders.
You can refuse illegal orders.
You must refuse illegal orders.
No one has to carry out orders that violate the law
or our Constitution.
We know this is hard
and that it's a difficult time to be a public servant.
But whether you're serving in the CIA,
the Army,
or Navy,
the Air Force,
your vigilance is critical.
And know that we have your back.
Because now, more than ever,
the American people need you.
We need you to stand up for our laws,
our Constitution,
and who we are as Americans. Don't give up.
Don't give up.
Don't give up.
Don't give up the ship.
So they're pretty clear about telling members of the military to not obey illegal orders, which they're not allowed to do. Not just from a moral standpoint, but from a legal standpoint. And Trump, who has never served his country and indeed dodged service when he was called upon by his country, responded with deranged, demented posts on social media calling this sedition and calling for the execution of these members of Congress. And Senator Murphy, who's just been on fire lately, observed in a response video that this was not only, you know, unhinged, insane, impeachable behavior, but it was also unprecedented. And he said, never before in American history has this happened. And I looked. And as far as I have been able to tell, I think Senator Murphy is right. Now, it is very difficult to prove a negative, especially on a short timeline. You know, I spent maybe 90 minutes surveying this and searching for various folks. And there are people like Andrew Jackson who, like, you kind of see that guy doing it. Or Andrew Johnson, right? Like, you know, I could see one of those guys doing it. But nothing that I could find. And I think part of it is, right, they didn't have social media, so they can't fire off this kind of insanity to the world without some sort of filter. It has to be written down and then disseminated, you know, written down with like quill and ink on parchment and then disseminated to some sort of other media apparatus that is, you know, 24 hours that we're talking about. And there's a lot of time to check that insane impulse between it entering the president's head and then it getting to the public. But this is truly dangerous. And whether or not it has happened in history, it is happening now. And it really is truly, truly dangerous. And there's two reasons that I think we need to be more worried about this than people seem to understand. And the first is that we no longer have an independent Department of Justice. This DOJ does whatever Trump posts on social media for the day. Like, there are direct connections between what Donald Trump has posted on social media and what Pam Bondi goes out and does as Attorney General, right? It often seems that the agenda of DOJ is set by Donald Trump's social media posts. So this is not hard to imagine Pam Bondi launching an investigation into these Democrats and making their lives miserable. And, you know, even maybe attempting to bring one of them, charges against one of them under 18 USC, which, you know, is the statute that houses things like treason, sedition, and subversive activities. I could easily see her trying to do that. It could happen. It could happen soon. And it doesn't matter if she's got a case, right? If Pam Bondi can build a legitimate case, launching a sedition or treason prosecution of a sitting member of Congress of the opposite party, first of all, I mean, that's going to be in the history books. That charge is going to be associated with their name forever. But it's also going to make their lives very, very different. I mean, the amount of money that they're going to have to spend on lawyers, the amount of time and effort that they and their family are going to have to spend on this, that is deeply, deeply troublesome. So it could be completely meritless prosecution, but it could still be deeply problematic for them. And the more alarming aspect of this is the stochastic terrorism of Donald Trump. Because just a few weeks ago, deranged, demented Donald and his party were screaming about political violence and attacking anybody that said they were authoritarians or fascists or dictators. Remember when Charlie Kirk was murdered and the reaction that they had to that? And I'm not talking about this from a hypocrisy standpoint, because the hypocrisy is it is so pungent as to be overwhelming, but it doesn't seem to move anybody on that side. But remember, we had on this podcast a Minnesota state senator whose colleague and her husband and her dog and her family were assassinated in their home, were murdered in their home. A Democratic state senator murdered in her home along with her husband and her dog by a MAGA nut. And Trump is a stochastic terrorist. He knows what he is doing. He knows he's calling down violence on these opposition members of Congress. That's why he's doing this. It's even quite possible he's furious about a certain vote that those members forced on his party earlier that same week, right? The Epstein Files vote. I mean, this could be very bad. I think that's part of the reason that Trump is doing this, is to call down violence on these members of Congress. Right? This is what he did on January 6th. Be there. We'll be wild. I'll march down to the Capitol with you. This is what he did at rally after rally. I'll bail you out of jail if you get arrested for beating somebody up. This is what he's doing with his pardons. It's winks and nudges and nods and a permission for his followers to go do violence in his name, because he'll protect them in the end. He'll pardon them in the end. He'll take care of them. And that is what is keeping me up at night with this. And normally, you know, you'd expect the FBI and other law enforcement to handle these threats without an issue. But these agencies are now being run by podcasters and election deniers and morons who fly around on their personal jets instead of working. So I don't have a lot of hope for that. And if your MAGA uncle does bring any of this up at Thanksgiving, you should check their Facebook page to see if they've posted anything about political violence after Charlie Kirk. Because I think face to face, the hypocrisy is a little harder for them to ignore in a face to face conversation. And let's turn to some other words that Donald Trump hurled at the world this week. The blatant misogyny of the quiet, quiet piggy that Donald Trump said on a plane while pointing at a female reporter.
There's growing controversy today over the president's treatment of a reporter aboard Air Force One.
Quiet piggy. I was so viscerally disgusted watching this. I mean, Donald Trump is just a fucking foul human being. This is not just an assault on free press. This is not just blatant misogyny. This is embarrassing for every man on that plane. Men who were in that room, on that plane, watching this happen, needed to call this shit out. And not just men. I mean, like, men need to be doing a much better job. It is absolutely fucking appalling that nobody said anything. But also, fellow journalists on that plane, none of them followed up with that same question. I don't know how you watch that happen to somebody who you work alongside, who has the same job as you, and don't immediately repeat her question ad nauseum until you get an answer from Donald Trump. Every one of them should have become her and stood up. And when Wife Liz, who you've all heard on this podcast, and I were ranting about this, she did point out one thing to me, which is that I somehow do not keep this centered. And that's that the press corps that we know of is not really there anymore, right? This is a different press corps. This is Donald Trump's OAN, you know, One American News. It's like, it's the sycophants and the podcasters that follow Trump around and Marjorie Taylor Greene's boyfriends, right? That's who's on this plane. Right? Christian nationalist news, MAGA news, and podcasters that love Trump. We also saw that, and this one kind of slid under the radar a little bit, but it's relevant because of this particular point, that podcasts are overwhelmingly, I say as a man doing a solo podcast right now, run by men. And it is male speakers on those podcasts, and that is a problem. And Liz Plank, whose book I have been reading right now, I actually just finished it this morning, and it has gone up to one of my top books of the year. And by the way, I will be doing an episode on the top reads of the year, and I've got them up as lists on my bookshop.org profile right now. Top nonfiction books of the year, top fiction books of the year, and For the Love of Men, Liz Plank's book on masculinity is one of my top nonfiction reads of the year. But she observed that even when a woman rises to the top, and this is the top of their field, for instance, in podcasting, even when a woman rises to the top, she's often expected to survive by echoing the very narratives that keep us out. Which she said on her Bros Really Do Dominate Podcasts Substack. That was the title. New study, Bros Really Do Dominate Podcasts, Substack. And she has a podcast, Boy Problems Show. I may try to get her on here to talk about it because I think masculinity is just such a fucking problem in this country right now. And I think you see part of it reflected in this disgusting display by Donald Trump. They didn't hide this, right? Donald Trump's team stood by his remarks. That's a terrible way to say it. Donald Trump's team stood by his misogyny. They stood by this disgusting hate. And spokespeople from Caroline Leavitt on down, including those who talked with Snopes, said, yeah, he said it. No big deal. But when I was looking at the YouTube video of the White House official YouTube page, and the reason I went to look is because I had only seen the clip of this, the 10, 15 second clip that everybody saw on their social media. And I wanted to know what I was just ranting about. Did anybody on this plane ask that same question over and over and over again? Because fuck you, Donald Trump. How dare you? Did anybody on this plane say anything to stand up for that reporter? Did anybody say anything on this plane to stand up for that woman? Fuck no, they didn't. And the reason I know that is because I went and looked at the full clip on the White House YouTube page. When I went there, right, I don't want to watch 30 minutes. I want to get to the point where he says this, and then I want to look after that and see if he said anything. So I searched through the transcript for the keyword, which is piggy. And it's not there. I'm like, oh, maybe this is the wrong video. Went and searched. Nope, it's definitely the right video. This is the suit he's wearing. This is the plane. This is the frame. This is the date. This is the time. And so I search quiet, and it's quiet. It shows up. It takes me to the spot in the transcript where it says quiet, quiet, and then in bracketed, inaudible. Quiet, quiet, inaudible. And I will tell you for a fact, you know that the White House put the transcript on the YouTube video. And you can see that because it says who was speaking, and it says the president, and then what he was saying, the press, and then what they were saying, right? You don't get that in a YouTube transcript that's automatically generated. They put the transcript together, the White House did. And that this is a dead, you know for a fact, the way it is written, that they put the transcript together. And they changed this so that it says quiet, quiet, inaudible. They removed the piggy, they removed the misogyny, they whitewashed Donald Trump here. They made him look like less of a bastard. And they did it, in my opinion, for history, for posterity. And we've been seeing them, and we have seen them doing this to our history, to things like the Smithsonian and to other aspects, to ask that the QR codes that we talked about for when people feel like they see something in a national park and it doesn't honor white Christian men enough, and they get to write a short little letter after the QR code saying you need to change this so that white Christian men feel special when they read it and not like they're not special. They've been changing our history line by line. I mean, it's very 1984. And I think that's what this is about, right? You get them standing up, right? Because, you know, when I broke this story, it kind of went semi-viral on, I think, Threads. And, you know, people are like, oh, they lied, big deal. You know, like, of course they lie. We know they lie. Yes, we know they lie. And it's a good question is then, well, why? Why do they care about this transcript? Why would they change this transcript if they don't care about being liars? And I think it's for posterity. I think it's so that 1, 2, 5, 10, 20, 50 years from now, when researchers are looking back, it's inaudible. We don't know. It doesn't come up if you search it. If you Google quiet, quiet piggy, that video is not going to come up because that phrase is not in there. You're not going to find the original. Maybe you'll see these 15-second clips, but if you're a researcher and a scholar, I mean, heck, I wanted to see the full video this week. Right? Maybe you chalk it up to AI. Who knows? We don't know what the world's going to look like after Trump is gone. May it be sooner rather than later. But I think this is about whitewashing him for posterity. And I'm so ashamed of everybody on that plane, but especially the men who let this happen. Shame on every single one of them. What a bunch of bastards. And I really hope, and this is not an Andrew original, it is something that I saw floating around on social media, and which made me do a shitty graphic design. I hope that when Donald Trump dies, that headlines read quiet, quiet piggy. And I hope that that is spray painted on his tombstone and on his hotels and anything that bears his name with the date of his death. And every time that it's cleaned up, I hope somebody goes and does it again. Because that is the least of what he deserves for this kind of disgusting behavior. I'm also just reminded of a while back, and this came back across my feed, an internet term, one of those lovely internet turns of phrase, Schrodinger's douchebag. And Schrodinger's douchebag is a guy, always a guy, who says these things, right? These offensive things, these borderline things. And then depending on how people react, all the people who hear him, right? That's what dictates whether or not he was joking. Right? Like, if people react poorly to what he has said, like, you're a fucking misogynist, you're a fucking racist, then it's, oh, no, I was just joking. But if they go along with it, and they like it, and they like what they're hearing, then they don't feel the need to say that they were joking, because they weren't. Folks, we still got so much to go. We got to get to Marjorie Taylor Greene, and we got to get to the first Thanksgiving and what you're going to do at Thanksgiving. Because Marjorie Taylor Greene is on an apologies tour, and we now know that she is retiring. And I was on a call with a donor talking about this, and one of the things I pointed out was that Marjorie Taylor Greene has been in the public and the political arena as a crazy person for years. I haven't looked up how long, right? But for years. And she's never needed security. She's never been in danger of death threats. But after just a few weeks, days almost, of being divided from Trump, and not divided from Trump, she's still way out there on the right fringe, still a far-right lunatic. But she's divided from Trump. Now she's facing all kinds of threats. And when people talk, and when your lunatic uncle, not your lunatic uncle, when you're your MAGA uncle starts talking about this at Thanksgiving, about that there's violence on both sides, just remind him that Marjorie Taylor Greene was on his side for years and is still on his side. And the second that she voiced any independence from Trump, she started getting death threats, facing all kinds of threats. And, you know, I've been struggling with Marjorie Taylor Greene a little bit and the conversation around her. Am I willing to give her grace? Because, look, I do think we need to make space for people to change their minds. Somebody once wrote that woke needs to make room for people waking up, which I thought was good advice. But if you are in the business of persuading people and trying to convince them and trying to get them to change their mind, you got to make space and room for them to do that. I mean, that should be a goal. You've got to give them that kind of soft landing. But that's not what's happening with Marjorie Taylor Greene, right? She's still very much a white Christian nationalist. You know, if you watch some of her interviews, even recently, she's still very much defending her relationships with white Christian nationalists like Nick Fuentes. She's still a conspiracy theorist when it comes to QAnon and Jewish people, right? She's less bad and less of an ally of Trump, and that's good. But less bad is not necessarily good. And again, we should still encourage people to apologize for their behavior. We should still make room for people who change their minds. And we should not only normalize that, but we should reward that. That should be something that we want, especially out of our politicians, so that they can get to the right place, whether policy or behavior in the end. And if we're ever going to break the feverish hold that Trump has on, you know, a quarter of the country, we need... We need that not only to happen, but for people to feel like they can do it. And I'm not saying that every commentator needs to forgive Marjorie Taylor Greene or anything like that. By no means. I'm not even saying that I am going to do that. But when you're sitting around the dinner table this Thanksgiving and Marjorie Taylor Greene comes up, it might be worth letting your MAGA relatives know that if it were them, not if it were Marjorie Taylor Greene, because fuck her, you don't know her. But if it were them, you might feel a little differently about a change of heart and an apology and forgiveness from them than you do for Marjorie Taylor Greene, right? It might be an opening. It might just be a little bit of a not a peace offering, but it might be a little bit of a thing that you could do to get them to at least wonder. And I'm not going to talk about Marjorie Taylor Greene anymore because she's still, I think, a terrible person at heart. And I don't want to waste time talking about her more. But let's talk about the real Thanksgiving before we go, because you're going to go to Thanksgiving dinner and you're going to have these conversations. And it's going to be fun to have some history at your fingertips. But also, I want to talk a little bit about what you should look for in those conversations. And we're going to start with the favorite American talking point, the favorite myth that the Pilgrims and the Puritans, which were different groups but always get lumped together and most Americans can't distinguish between them, when they came here, they were seeking religious freedom. When they came to America, they were seeking religious freedom. Somebody will say that. And that is not true. People, Puritans, pilgrims, did not come to this country seeking religious freedom. They were fleeing persecution. But fleeing persecution is not the same as seeking religious freedom. And I explain this quite a bit in the Founding Myth. And the distinction here, fleeing persecution versus seeking religious freedom, that distinction is crucial. The Puritans and the Pilgrims did not come for religious freedom. They fled persecution. And you can actually see this in the path that the Pilgrims took. Because the Pilgrims fled persecution in England. Right? They were being persecuted in England, so they fled England. But they didn't come to America. What, Andrew? What are you talking about? No, they went to Leiden in Holland, in the Netherlands. That is where they landed, and they were there for like a decade. And the government there tolerated their minority religion and gave them really more religious freedom. It's not the religious freedom we would call it today, but more religious freedom than was available anywhere else in the world, or in Europe, certainly. But freedom wasn't enough for the Pilgrims because others were free too, including their flock, including the people who were supposed to be staying in their church. And the iron grip that they had starts to slip. The Pilgrims don't want religious freedom. They wanted a government that would enforce their particularly stringent brand of Christianity. That's what they wanted. They couldn't get that in Holland. And so they left Holland, and after a quick stop in England on the way to the New World, came to the New World, which, you know, was not the New World because there were people here. And we can say the same thing with the Puritans. Right, the Puritans also wanted a government that would enforce their particularly stringent brand of Christianity. The Puritans regularly banished and even executed people over theological disagreements. That's not religious freedom. That is theocracy. It's my theocracy, and it's just as wrong, just as abusive. And it was an example of the framers of our Constitution, by the way, of how not to build a state. And the most important thing, I think, well, one of the most important things to remember here is who was doing the persecuting? Who were the persecutors of the Puritans and the Pilgrims that felt they needed to flee religious persecution? Other Christians. It was other Christians. Other Christians were doing the persecuting. This is so often just ignored and forgotten and elided. Christians persecuting Christians. Christian-on-Christian violence. That's like a good chunk of European history is that. And for all that we were taught in school about the Pilgrims breaking bread with indigenous people, they more often sought to break their bodies and spirits. The Puritans waged a literal holy war on the Pequots. They set fire to a village on the Mystic River, killing 700 indigenous men, women, and children, and sold the survivors into slavery. This is like something out of the book of Joshua from the Bible, right? Full of genocides. And the Puritans certainly saw it that way. Their commander, their militia commander, was a guy named John Mason. And Mason wrote an unashamed account of the slaughter. And he writes that his God laughed while his men slaughtered. Quote, God was above them who laughed his enemies and the enemies of his people to scorn, making them as a fiery oven. Yeah, let that one sink in. Making them as a fiery oven. That is really something. Especially with the haunting history of that idea today. Mason concludes, thus did the Lord judge among the heathen, filling the place with dead bodies. Yeah. Puritans and Pilgrims did not come to America seeking religious freedom. They were fleeing religious persecution, and they were being persecuted by other Christians. That's why we have a separation of church and state in this country. When they came here, they set up shitty little mini theocracies that failed. And the Founding Fathers were like, that is a terrible way to run a country. We're not going to do that. So also this whole idea of the Mayflower Compact being a founding document, no. No, absolutely not. It's an interesting piece of history, but no, That is not an influential or founding document at all, at least not on the American Republic as we know it. It maybe was on that failed state, that failed theocracy, but that's about it. And as you're having these hard conversations with family at Thanksgiving, I just want to reiterate two things. And the first is that you should not expect to change people's mind in the moment. And that should not be your goal, especially if you know this person is going to disagree with you. That should not be your goal. Your goal should not be to persuade them and change their mind and get them to say, wow, you're right, I was wrong. The goal should be to plant a seed of doubt. And the second goal should be, and this is the second thing, to do it in a way that if you're serious about changing people's minds, and that's your goal, your end goal, to plant that seed of doubt in a way that leaves the conversation open and leaves the relationship open for them to come back to you when they have real questions. And the way to do this is to ask genuine questions that lead them to question their own beliefs. It's active listening and asking good questions, not hitting them back with facts and figures, even though I just gave you some lovely facts that debunk some of their myths. But you can do that in a way, huh, you said they were coming for religious freedom. Why? Were they being persecuted? Oh, they were. Who was persecuting them? Oh, did they have religious freedom when they came here? Oh, no? Did they? What did they do? There are ways to do it, right? Oh, that's interesting. I thought they set up their own little kind of like theocracies where they didn't let people have religious freedom, and I thought the Puritans even like executed some of the Quakers, like Mary Dyer on the Boston Common. I thought I remembered reading about that when I was visiting Boston on a memorial plaque. That doesn't sound like religious freedom. Does it sound like religious freedom to you? Oh, so maybe they were just fleeing persecution, not coming to establish religious freedom, right? There are ways to do it, but the goal is to plant those seeds of doubt, because the reality is you're not going to change somebody's mind. They have to change their own mind. And so don't go into the conversation expecting to change their mind. Don't go into the debate expecting to change their mind. In fact, as debates happen, we learn that people engaged in the debate tend to come out more firmly entrenched in their position than they were going in. The people listening to the debate, on the other hand, those minds can change. So temper your expectations, plant the seed of doubt, and then leave the conversation open so that they can come back to you with more questions later on. That's how I have done things like this for years. I've found success in doing that. It allows for Thanksgiving to not devolve into utter chaos and madness and screaming matches. And I mean, look, maybe you want that. You know, if you want to save money on Christmas presents, you just bring up Christian nationalism at Thanksgiving. That'll do the trick. But always, always, always remember that life is too good to waste on bad ideas. And until next time, my friends, thanks for listening. This has been One Nation Indivisible. I'm Andrew Seidel. Until next time.
Have you ever heard something like, you should be ashamed just for being your true, authentic self? Then Teología Sin Vergüenza might be the place for you. We are queer trans feministas from Latin America and its diaspora who aren't ashamed of our faith or our activism. Our weekly conversations offer a space for reflection, analysis, and spiritual reclamation as we try to navigate home, faith, familia, and identity. So grab a cup of coffee, whether it's café con leche, café cubano, café de olla, tinto, chorreado, or americano. Join us for the deep dive into the lives of theologians, elders, activists, and everyday saints as we talk about decolonial faith, gender justice, sexuality, and sacred resistance. I'm your host, Reverend Sex. And for all of those who feel like you aren't enough of this or too much of that, ni de aquí, ni de allá, you belong here. Join us for shameless faith conversations about real life right now that you won't find anywhere else. You might just realize that you are a sinvergüenza too.